This is Marilyn Gleason, and today in the studio, I have a couple of great guests. We're going to be talking about the Middle Colorado Watershed Council, which brings up a lot of issues that are really important to people in this valley and around the state of Colorado and around the West right now. I have Paula Stepp. She's a well-known and visible community member from here. She ran as a Democrat for the Garfield County Commission a few years ago, served on the Glenwood Springs City Council, and has operated this soundboard right here in KDNK before. Hi, Paula.
Hey, and I miss that soundboard. I have to come back and do some of that again.
The soundboard is dying.
Oh, no.
Yeah, certain channels are just losing their volume. We need to play that Grateful Dead song, not Fade Away. Yeah, this is kind of my, I'm going to keep mentioning it because we need about $12,000, I think.
It's a great end
of the year contribution to KDNK, and you'll be able to hear us loud and clear for another 30 years. We also have in the studio Kate Collins, and she has worked with a lot of nonprofits, Alpine Bank, other, and has been a longtime community member, and is the new executive director recently hired. She's even newer at the Middle Colorado Watershed Council than I am at KDNK. So I'd love to welcome Kate.
Thank you, Marilyn. You and I will stumble through this together, I guess.
We'll do fine. So Kate envisions a future that balances economic growth with environmental responsibility. And as the daughter of a reservation-born Northern Arapaho tribal member, she believes her passion for conservation is informed by the ecological consciousness of her ancestors. So that's a big legacy to bring to the job.
I feel that. It's been interesting as I've gotten older. I feel it more and more. And a couple of years ago, I went to the History Colorado, the new Sand Creek Massacre exhibit there. And it just brought a lot of things together for me. So that's been a powerful experience. And to drop into that heritage, do a little more research on my ancestors. My great-great-grandmother actually escaped the Sand Creek Massacre.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
That's why I get to be alive here today.
A little deviation here, but not really. Where did you see that exhibit?
It's at the History Colorado Museum in downtown Denver. I believe it's on or nearby Arapaho Street.
Mm-hmm. I've been to the Sand Creek Massacre site a few years ago. We were traveling back from Kansas, and instead of taking the interstates, we took the back roads and actually saw a lot of Native American sites on the way home and stopped at the Sand Creek Massacre. And anybody who hasn't been there should go there. And I think we saw that exhibit, but it's been moved out to one of the little towns out in eastern Colorado in its own space. And I can't remember if it's Chivington or
Eads is the town that's closest to there, but they have so they had the exhibit like 10 years ago. They got it all wrong. Tribes were mad. The Cheyenne and Arapaho were like, hey, you guys didn't nail this. So they redid it just 2 years ago, and so it should be a long-standing exhibit, as far as I know, for a long time to come.
Yeah, and this was definitely more from the perspective of the Native Americans. And again, very powerful. If you get a chance to see it, go
thank
do
you.
It. On to the business. You're busy. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Middle Colorado Watershed Council and what you really see your mission and your work as being.
So the Middle Colorado Watershed Council started in 2009 when stakeholders got together and said, we really need to take care of the water in this region, which runs from the east end of Glenwood Canyon all the way to Debeck Canyon. There are other watershed nonprofits and other groups that work on the health of our rivers. Eagle has one. As everybody knows in this valley, there's a Roaring Fork Conservancy, which is great for taking care of that river and the Frying Pan and the Crystal. So they said, what about the quality and quantity of water in that stretch of water? And so they got together with everybody they could think of as a stakeholder and water user, from the ag community, municipal, recreation, the natural resource agencies like CPW and Forest Service, BLM, oil and gas, you name it. If you used water, you were in those conversations on how do we take care of the quality and the quantity of this resource. And as we have experienced now almost 23 years of drought, that's a precious resource that all of us need to sit down and think about and take care of.
And it's something that's being talked about and taken more seriously really everywhere throughout the West and even throughout the entire country now. You didn't really used to hear about it so much, but now it's on NPR all the time.
Right. I think with aridity on the increase and drought and wildfires and population increase, and we know that we have a finite quantity of water, and that there's enough for everyone, but we have to get really, really smart about how we use it. And just the Colorado River alone supports 40 million people, and then that Colorado River Basin is seven states.
Yeah, that's a lot of people. It's a lot of little Dixie
Isn't
cups
that
of
something?
Water.
Right, our beautiful Colorado River, if you contemplate it flowing by and thinking really of all the people, really all life depends on it.
And it's so funny to the ownership, and in my term with Middle Colorado, if you come to somebody from Utah or California, that perspective, it's our Colorado River. And it's like, no, all of us participate in this Colorado River from Colorado down to California, Mexico, 35 tribes, just to kind of embrace that bigness of what we're really talking about. And like you said, it's in the news all the time now because of Lake Powell and Lake Mead and how to divide a resource that's pretty much come to almost the cusp of not fisticuffs, but sometimes you feel like those conversations are like, what's yours and what's mine and how do we make this work together?
Hey, don't they say whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. Absolutely.
And I think I failed to mention that Paula has been the executive director for the last 4 years. So we have the outgoing and the incoming executive director and directors of the council, and you're having a little overlap time to pass that baton.
Absolutely, and I'm glad that we set aside the funding to do that. Well, Kate can explain it a bit, but there's a lot.
Right. Every day, I thank my lucky stars that Paula will be remaining in the role as we transition through December, because in the last 4 years, oh my goodness, she's put so many programs in place. And really what we have done is we've created an integrated water management plan that really was finalized in about February 2021. Mm-hmm. And we focus on four main areas: recreation, aquatic biota, consumptive use, and water quality. Yeah. And so it integrates with the state's plan. So it's kind of like 30,000 foot view. We go from broad down to specific. And then that integrated water management plan elicited 55 priorities. We don't address them all at once, thank goodness. But in collaboration with the board, we identify three or four priorities a year and several overlap. And I think right now we have 14 active projects underway in those four main categories.
Wow. Yeah, when you were talking before, I was thinking, okay, big ideas. Now, how do these turn into, little boots on the ground? What's your favorite project right now of those 14?
Such an amazing question. I think I'm really excited most generally about restoration and restoration of our riparian areas and our waterways so that we can support more biodiversity, right? And get back to the species that are supposed to be there, the plants and animals that were originally there and that are supposed to be there in a healthy river system.
And what's the biggest threat or damage to those riparian areas?
Well, one is drought, because when there's less water, that causes all kinds of problems. you know, one is riverbanks that become compromised, and so you see a lot of incised riverbanks and things. They're not, you know, meandering healthy waterways the way that they ought to be.
Like when they put down all that riprap and more channelization? Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about? Just a lot of erosion?
A lot of erosion.
Mm-hmm. Impacts from grazing, those kind of things that just tear up a riverbank and take away that riparian area.
Yeah, and so we've got some gravel pit restoration opportunities or, helping with fluvial hazards, so, you know, flooding areas that are prone to flooding, and some of the crazy outcomes from post-fire with our water quality and mudslides and those sorts of things.
Speaking of flooded areas, I guess one of the things that you've been working on, Paula, over the last 4 years is the restoration from the Grizzly Fire, or water monitoring and water quality and and weather monitoring as well.
Yeah, that sounds kind of strange, doesn't it? Yeah, so I came into this position right after the Grizzly Creek Fire, which also was the area was impacted by the Pine Gulch Fire down in the Dubuque area.
And I'm just going to take a second and just explain the things that probably everybody already knows, but the Grizzly Creek Fire was in Glenwood Canyon in 2020, the summer of our discontent, when there was a big fire burning in Glenwood Canyon and another big fire. I live in Newcastle, so I was between the Pine Gulch Fire, which was down near Dubuque.
Right.
And it was just a smoky mess around here, plus COVID. So,
plus, when Pine Gulch burned, when it was burning, it was the biggest fire in Colorado's history. But it was quickly superseded by East Troublesome later that season.
Great name.
And then Cameron Peak. I mean, so four major fires, which caused the state to have the three largest fires in Colorado's history, and the impact of the Grizzly Creek Fire raise our eyebrows, and legislature said we need to do something to be more fire ready.
And the Grizzly Creek Fire is right there at I-70, which is such a fragile and important conduit,
especially
in our modern society.
Especially as a transportation zone. I mean, the thousands and thousands of vehicles that go through there, the impacts to our economies when that shuts down, the impact of that on our economy on top of COVID. So we had COVID in March, a fire in August, and then within a year we had the canyon shut down because of debris flows due to that fire. So it's definitely an artery that again, the state kind of comes back and go, how do we keep this from happening to such a degree anywhere in the state of Colorado, but this kind of impact that it makes. But we jumped in because of looking at what that would mean after the fire. Any fire, you're always looking at flooding and debris flows afterwards, which changes the quality of your water, which means it's going to have an impact on your ag community, agriculture community, and on those city water treatment plants that take the water out of the river. So we found funding from the state to help with that, and then we also found funding to increase the number of put in rain gauges in Glenwood Canyon in seven locations to help the National Weather Service monitor weather so they knew when to shut the canyon down. So that's the weather monitoring part of it. So that
okay, so that's when we're getting those warnings that possible flash floods in Glenwood Canyon, you might be diverted to Meeker.
That's it, yeah. Meeker, Steamboat, you get to take the long journey. So that kind of got us into... We ended up with that IWMP that Kate had talked about. That was wrapping up at the end of 2020, and all of a sudden it was like, well, okay, fire also is a part of our water quality, water quantity issues that we need to keep in there. And because of that impact from the Grizzly Creek Fire, we ended up focusing a lot of attention of the time that we had available on kind of that post-fire world, and then working with both the Roaring Fork Valley and the Middle Colorado Valley on building collaboratives to be ready for the next wildfire and those events.
So how easy is it forming these collaborations in your area?
So people have talked about cat herding, and this is a little bit more like goldfish herding. it's like pulling people together, and they're all busy. You know, you're building a collaborative, and it's and they're not getting paid. And it's like, how do we sit down at the table and make things work? How do we find our subcommittees? How do we go to the next step? And it's just a constant process of re-engaging and bringing them to the table, and allowing the time for it to develop. You know, so
Paula's made it look easy. Yeah, don't let her fool you. I think one thing that's really exciting about it is that it's a cross-jurisdictional organization. So when you think about a river, it doesn't care about municipal boundaries, right?
And we didn't really design our boundaries with the watersheds in mind, as Powell would have suggested we do.
Exactly.
That would have been good.
Yeah, and so I just think the level of engagement and really enthusiasm for that project is pretty amazing. And the fact that that framework is in place so that we're ready. You know, we're ready for something that might happen in the future. We hope it doesn't.
And that's really that cross-jurisdictional part of it. That's the basis of the Middle Colorado Watershed Council as well. I mean, you know, all the towns and agriculture community, they all have their own entities, and they all work towards getting, you know, making things work for them and taking care of problems that they have. But this allows an opportunity for us to bring people together, whether it is post-fire or it's a water quality type of project like stream restoration and stuff like that, where we have that kind of more regional focus in the watershed.
I'm going to back up a little bit and just ask you, how is the water quality coming out of Glenwood Canyon? How is our water quality post-fire?
We're
today?
Actually doing good now. The revegetation has helped lessen the impacts of those summer monsoons. The impacts from runoff were not as big as people thought they would be. When you look at some of the testing of that water, in most cases, we're seeing the similar, not quite the same, but similar to what we had for water quality pre-Grizzly Creek fire. So that's good news, just kind of the work that's been done on restoration and watching nature take its course as well.
And also the flooding following that fire really changed the river through Glenwood Canyon, didn't it?
It did. We had just finished, I've got in front of me so nobody in the audience can see, but we had just finished in 2020, and we're going to print with our river running guide to the Colorado River, and it shows all the access points. And of course, in Glenwood Canyon, some of those access points were slightly adjusted due to rock flow in the river. Mm-hmm. But still a usable document, and when we go to a reprint, we can get some updates done on it.
Well, another project that's about to start is a Roan Creek fish barrier. I assume Roan Creek comes down from Roan Plateau, which is kind of a wild and remote area where there's also been a lot of gas drilling and controversy at times in the past. And yeah, what's the fish barrier for?
Yeah, so do you want to take this?
Sure. So my very good friend, George Ware, who used to be on the board here, and he's a water resources engineer, when I started talking about applying for this job, he goes, well, Kate, you're going to have a lot of places where you want to keep fish out and where you want to let fish in. And so,
wow.
You know, that was his big advice to me. And so we have a reach above there that has our native cutthroat trout that we want to keep that population pure and healthy and vital. And so it's a barrier so that none of the fish that shouldn't be there get up there.
Like brown trout, which tend to outcompete the cutthroat?
Exactly.
Brown. Or hybridize. You don't want to hybridize those fish. You want the pure strain, especially in these more protected fish.
How rare are those native cutthroat?
Yeah, I don't know that I can speak to that exactly. You know, they found some outside of Colorado Springs a few years ago in a little creek outside of Bear Ranch, and kind of nobody knew they were there. So they're around, and I think there are some programs in place to propagate them as well, but to try to keep the habitat safe and pure where they already are. is really important.
And your cutthroat are of different lineages, and there's they're identified sometimes by where they're from. So that makes a difference as well, you know, that you might have a particular breed in a particular creek that you want to keep separate from other, like you said, non-native or species that are considered that could damage that habitat. And right now, CPW goes up and mechanically takes out those brown trout to keep them from going up to those last 12 miles of Roan Creek. So this is to kind of go back to a situation where you've got a basically a cement wall that those non-native species can't get past up to those cutthroat so that you can keep them pure.
Very interesting. I'll let our listeners know that I'm talking to Paula Stepp, who we were just hearing, and Kate Collins, who are the outgoing and incoming executive directors of the Middle Colorado Watershed Council. And yeah, you are also working on ways for people to report non-native species.
Yes, indeed. We have a non-native fish app. And we have seven, we've got mollusks and fish. I just did this thing by the numbers for an e-newsletter, so I thought
five
I would...
Five fish. Four mollusks.
And four mollusks.
Okay.
That should not be in our waterways. And so we are asking citizens, anybody who uses the river, if they identify any of the species that should not be in there, like zebra mussels, for example, or quagga mussels, this New Zealand mud snail, or rusty crayfish, that they can send that information in via a QR code, and that goes to the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Department, and so they can track that and hopefully, you know, mitigate those bad guys getting into waterways. There's also northern pike and striped bass, burbo, smallmouth bass, and walleye.
So you're developing this app?
It is developed. It is underway.
Mm-hmm. The app is done. The little brochure piece you're holding in your hand was designed so that if you buy a fishing license, we'll have these at angling shops and that type of stuff, that you could pick up both, and if they're pulled out of the river and you identify them off these pictures on the card, you can get to the app through that QR code and report it, take a picture of the fish. And this allows CPW to be aware of locations that these fish are being found or the mollusks that they may not be aware of. They know where they are in a lot of our waterways, but they don't know where all the places are. And, you know, CPW, like everybody, has a limited staff, so this is just to help them find where these might be causing problems. In particular, what was good about this is this was rolling out, and we had the zebra mussel problem that was identified in the Colorado River. And so we were able to kind of expand the messaging more on how important it is that when people get out of the water, that they clean their boots, they clean their boats, they dry them before they get into the next body of water to keep these things from spreading through our waterways.
This is a really big deal. And let's talk a little more about these little zebra mussels. This picture that I'm looking at here, it kind of looks like the end of my thumb, the zebra mussel, but they're actually very tiny.
The veligers are. What they're finding in the river is pre-shelled fish, if that's the best way to say it. It's kind of like the larva stage. Mm. And they're very, very, very tiny. You have to have a microscope, basically, to see them. But the idea is there's a source somewhere in the river that those are coming from, and where is it coming from? So you would be, if you had a pond and you could see the actual zebra mussels that you're looking at there, the one that you said was look thumb size.
But they're tinier than that.
No, they're bigger than that. They're actually bigger. Yeah. Then you would say, I've got an infestation of some kind of mollusk, and CPW could come and help and actually may not be able to remove them completely, but do a lot of mitigating to dry out the pond or whatever it is that they're sitting in. The bigger part is we know they're in the waterways. They haven't been identified this far upstream. But the concern is as they move in, it's almost impossible to get rid of them. So it's being the public outreach right now to do everything we can to keep them as far downstream as possible is really important, because it'll hurt our agricultural community. It gets in and it covers everything. They become mollusks that encrust shoes and shells, pipes and whatever you put in the river, so they get encrusted.
They're clogging up the agricultural pipes. I know Highline Lake and Highline State Park has been draining the lake up there because of the zebra mussel problem, and there's a lot of agriculture around there. So, they reproduce at a very high rate.
They do. So we're doing whatever we can to kind of get the message out. Not like we were talking earlier, I've talked with Rico LaFaro and from Roaring Fork Conservancy and Eagle County's watershed group, and it's like, how do we do this all together to get this messaging out? So,
well, we have run to the end of time here.
it
flies
fast.
And there's more things to talk about, but maybe we'll just have to have you back again sometime, Kate. Wildfire rivers, water, zebra mussels.
Can we give everybody our URL? We'd love for you guys to look at all the different sites.
It's midcowatershed.org. Sign up for our newsletter. Sign up to volunteer. Make a donation.
All right. Thank you so much, Paula Stepp and Kate Collins. Keep it tuned for news here on KDNK.